Hi, it's Rabbi Jim Egolf. I want to thank you so much for joining me. Well, we're going to have a sermon about Passover this week and take a look at the Torah portion, the Haftarah especially, and then begin to talk a little bit about some of the firsts that we've recently experienced. And they were pretty significant firsts. I really thank you for joining me because it means a lot to have you listen, and I would love to hear comments, questions, ideas. You can always email me at rav as in Victor, J-I-M, at AOL.com, or you could Skype me. You can call me on my Skype line, 610-624-3441 from any American landline, and leave me a voicemail. And I'd love to share your comments, questions, or what have you on this particular program. Well, again, thank you for joining me. I hope you have a great week, and please continue to listen. Shalom. So there's a joke that comes from Kosher for Passover jokes. And the joke goes that Moses was sitting in an Egyptian ghetto. Things were terrible. Pharaoh wouldn't speak to him. The rest of the Israelites were mad at him and for making the overseers even more irritable than usual. He was about ready to give up. Suddenly a booming voice from above. "You, Moses, heed me. I have good news and bad news." Moses was staggered. The voice continued, "You, Moses, will lead the people of Israel from bondage. If Pharaoh refuses, I will smite Egypt with frogs. You, Moses, will lead the people of Israel. And if Pharaoh refuses, I will smite Egypt with a plague of locusts. You, Moses, will lead the people of Israel to freedom and safety. And if Pharaoh pursues you, I will destroy his army at the Red Sea." Moses was stunned. He stammered, that's terrific, your eternal ship. I can't believe it, but what's the bad news?" "You, Moses, your job is to write the environmental impact statement." In a recent article that appeared in Haaretz, the reason for the 10 plagues was supposedly a violent eruption someplace in the Mediterranean Sea. According to an article by Ofri Ilani, who is quoting a Dr. Sivertson someplace in Chicago, I believe at the University of Chicago, in their conversation, Dr. Sivertson basically argues that in the year 1628 BCE, an enormous volcanic eruption nearly destroyed the island of Santorini in the Aegean, and the effects of the eruption reached Egypt, causing dramatic climatic phenomena. The eruption caused an acid rain cloud, making things dark, and there was thunder. Sivertson said that she became frustrated in reading the description of the Exodus because she realized that these were clearly volcanic events, but could find no serious explanation of this kind. The plague of blood, she explains, was that red weeds that multiplied as a result of the volcanic ash. And then came frogs. According to her, if you were a frog, you too would come out in such circumstances. The only plague that is not related to the volcanic eruption is the death of the firstborn. She suggests this was the result of massive food poisoning, which did not affect the Hebrews because they kept a different diet. Yeah, but did they all feed the firstborn the same exact thing? I mean, was it, you know, "The firstborn, thou shalt eat bad peanut butter." Anyway, you get the idea. Apologies to people who've been dealing with the peanut butter issue, but you get the idea. It doesn't really make sense. So, I read this particular discussion, this particular excuse, if you will, for the plagues, for everything else that happened during the Passover, and I got to thinking. I really got to thinking. What does this kind of an excuse do to Passover? I mean, literally, does it really add anything? Between the various views of the holiday of or circumstances of Passover, we find our comfort and discomfort with this holiday of unleavened products. When we approach all of our holidays, all of our texts, more often than not, the interpretation we bring to the text is more about us than the actual text. If you're somewhat mollified or feel some sense of relief that the plagues could be attributed to natural events, then perhaps that tells you something about how you see the world. If, however, you categorically reject the notion of a scientific apology for the miraculous and need to cling to the fundamentalist understanding of the text, regardless of any natural or scientific explanation, that's also a sign of how you view the world. Regardless of your personal view, approach, and reason for Passover, we are still left with one piece of this story that leaves many in awe, whether they're comfortable with miracles or not. And that's the power of the story. A few years ago, you might have heard that a certain Rabbi Wolpe, David Wolpe, was roundly criticized for questioning the historicity of the Exodus in, I believe, the Los Angeles Daily Times. Even congregants in my small southern city heard of this article, and while they did not believe in the staff of Moses and all the theatrics of the Exodus, they came to me to express criticism of Wolpe, even though I think most may have agreed with the content of the article. Rabbi Wolpe essentially said the Passover as we describe it did not occur. In a rational, scientific, historical way, he was right. He probably still is right. Where his article fell flat was in the lack of understanding of the power of the story, even if all of its facts are somewhat in doubt. For all the ways to prove that Passover may or may not have happened as we describe it, there is no way that we can deny the strength and conviction that the story of the Exodus has lent to a vast array of people. It is a reminder that the story may have legal accuracy problems, but legal accuracy and the power to inspire are usually two different categories when it comes to the hope people search for in the world. This comes out in our Haftarah, which involves another powerfully inspiring image. In Babylonia, by the waters of one of the great rivers there, was one of our prophets who had a vision. Ezekiel is known for a variety of bizarre and fantastic images, whether it is the wheel and the wheel from his first and tenth chapters, or the eating of the scroll. Now, you know, the eating of the scroll, I have to say, that's making an extreme excuse for not doing your bar mitzvah homework. But anyway, or the image this week, Ezekiel seems to always strain the imagination. In this week's Haftarah, God appears to the prophet as he looks over a valley of dry bones. God instructs Ezekiel to speak to the bones, and as if by magic, the bones begin to move. Commentators reveal their comfort, or their lack of comfort, with this image. According to Rashi, the bones began to kind of go together, you know, the hip bones connected to, literally like that, as if by magic. According to another commentator who comes along and says, no. See, the bones were very dry, and they're very close together, and there was a tremor, and that's how the bones began to move. That's according to a different commentator. Regardless of which one you like, the commentators' reactions tell us about their comfort or lack thereof with this image. How we read the text and react to this miracle tells us more about our belief system than we might always want to admit. And it is in this vein that I want to talk about a miracle that happened this week. As some of you might have heard during the recent election, there were various attempts to raise questions about our president's religious convictions. I personally received no less than 5 faxes or emails at Beth David attempting to convince me that due to candidate Obama's religious perspectives as a Muslim, that he would be an enemy of the state of Israel. As if this were true, then issues with Reverend Wright really should have been issues with Imam Wright, but nobody seemed to pick up on that one. Then there's the further problem that continued in the form of the religious makeup of the First Family's holiday celebrations. It was reported in September of 2008, Michelle Obama, wife of the Democratic presidential nominee, and Rabbi Capers Punye, spiritual leader of a mostly black synagogue on Chicago's South Side, are first cousins once removed. Funé's mother, Verdell Robinson Funé, and Michelle Obama's paternal grandfather, Frazier Robinson Jr., were brother and sister. Funé is the chief rabbi at Beth Shalom B'nai Zaken, Ethiopian Hebrew congregation in southwest Chicago, and he is well-liked in Jewish circles for acting as a bridge between mainstream Jewry in the much smaller and largely separate world of black Jewish congregations, sometimes known as black Hebrews or Israelites. He has often urged the larger Jewish community to be more accepting of those Jews who are not white. I'm not sure that this story confirms that our president is or is not a Muslim. What it does show is the diversity embodied in the makeup of our First Family. Now the miracle I want to talk about is the first Seder ever to be hosted by a sitting president of the United States. That's right, the new president and his wife were the first to host a Seder in the White House. While there had previously been Seders, this was the first to be put on by the First Family, and it was done for the staffers from last year's campaign. Now, I just want to put this in sharp contrast to 65 years ago, and we'll see a drastically different view of our first residents. Now, this is from the Jewish Telegraph Agency. In 1943, rabbis marched to the White House to demand action from the President of the United States to save European Jewry from the Nazis. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt responded by sneaking out of the White House's back door to avoid seeing the rabbis. You know, times seem to have changed a little bit. This week, as we gathered around our Seder tables, it is remarkable that the meals we shared, and hopefully some of the meaning we shared, was also found in the White House. It was reported by one of the blogs of the LA Times. The Passover story, with its Exodus themes of liberation and social justice, is a good fit for Team Obama. But one can only imagine how confusing this will be for critics who insist that the Christian president is really a Muslim. One side note, at the end of the Seder, it's traditional to say next year in Jerusalem. But last year, the campaign crowd ended its service with next year in the White House. This year, one aide said, the staff will use the holiday to reflect on all that has happened in our lives since last year's Seder in Harrisburg. Why is this night different from other nights? President Clinton's staff held Seders, but he did not attend, making the Obamas the first to host a Seder at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. That's from the Los Angeles Daily Times. Yes, I know that in light of the various problems our nation faces, this might appear to be a trivial event. Yet for Jews, for all minorities, we find that becoming a nation of many faiths and seeing appropriate reflections of faith is something that adds to the rich diversity of our great nation. My hope is that this first Seder will be followed by the first celebration of Eid, the feast ending the month of Ramadan. For such events teach us a lesson. While many may look for natural or supernatural phenomena to explain many of the things we hear described in our religious texts. We should never abandon the ability to make the miraculous ourselves. Shavua Tov. May you have a good week.